So, as yet, I haven't produced anything like an argument, and I'm not going to start now. I want today to continue this strategy of introducing Kant's language, his structures of thought, his terminology today. If you're following the actual syllabus, I am still on Kant on myself, so we will be talking about the paralogisms at some point today for an hour or so. To try to introduce Kant on the I think. And I'll, in doing that, I'll be continuing my deflationary strategy by showing you how fundamentally uninteresting the I think is. All this is continual activity of deflation. But of course, that's what I'm also trying to do by building up these structures and vocabulary to, as the saying goes, get all my little ducks in a row. So suddenly, when I'm ready to produce the transcendental deduction, it will just come out like, you know, a walk in the park. That's kind of the idea. You build up the structures, you get the hang of the strategies, and then ideally it all should kind of just gel together in a wonderful scintillating gestalt that will change your life forever. So I want to pick up today. We finished in the middle of the threefold synthesis apprehension, reproduction, and recognition in a concept. And all of this, recall, is an attempt to begin to get at, whatever Kant might mean by his combination of synthesis. That is the idea that we have to put the manifold together, we have to synthesize it, we have to combine it, another word he uses over and over again, into a unity of some kind. And that the principle that he's operating with is, for cognitive purposes, nothing will count as unified, as being a unity, unless unified. That is, for every product in a Kantian world, there is an active process underlying it. So you can use the, if you're like me and simple mind, you can just use it as a slogan, no product without process. Right? And the Kant's thought here is, and this is really maybe the thought of the whole book, is that we have products, awarenesses of the world, and underlying them is a complicated process, and he's unearthing the nature, character, and structure of that process, that synthetic activity, to reveal, therefore, the meaning of what we already have. So in that way, the revelation is simply a revelation of how human activity structures and orients the world as it is always already experienced. And I suggested that the synthesis of apprehension is involves the recognition of a manifold as a manifold, In broad terms, this means recognizing spatio and temporal complexity, and that I suggested that the reason why Kant, although the synthesis of apprehension never occurs on its own, it always occurs in tandem with the synthesis of reproduction, I suggested that Kant separates it out analytically as a separate moment for the sake of underlining the fact that synthesis is a matter of sensible response to the world. So that all of this is about how we are responding to what we are doing with the given, how we are taking it up and working it through in order to finally make a judgment, and that these forms are precisely that, forms of synthesis, patterns of our activity. I then said that the synthesis of reproduction has kind of comes close to what Derrida calls iterability. And of course, what Derrida calls iterability is his linguistic reformulation of what Heidegger means by the critique of presentness, or the critique of the present, to show that there is no present on its own, and that the way in which Kant does this is by suggesting that there can be, so all of this is about, let's call it, for simplicity's sake, the now, the present, and its logical secondariness, its derivability, its non-primitiveness. That's what all the heavy breathing in Heidegger and Derrida, it's very heavy breathing, you know, you think something grand is happening, but, well, it's kind of grand. It's grand to know that the now is never now. Well, why not? And the argument that Kant uses to say that for Derrida's version of the yes is always the yes, yes. Right? That's his Molly Bloom moment. it's the most, well, he is consciously A.P. Molly Bloom when he's talking about the yes, yes. He's talking about the end of Joyce's book. It's the thought that there cannot be a first without a second. And the way of thinking about that, and then I'll do it mentalistically, is in cognitive terms, nothing can count as first unless there is a second that follows it. So nothing can count as the number one. The word number one cannot be primitive unless and until there's a number two. So in a certain sense, it's only in the light of number two that one becomes one, and therefore it's only in light of a later moment that an earlier moment can count as the present it was. That is, every present is the present of an existing past, and therefore is not present by itself, but only present in light of that past. And I suggested that the way of thinking about this is to think of simple examples in which our capacity to think of something as a beginning requires the holding in mind of that beginning, right? And the holding in mind, this is what the reproductive imagination does, it holds in mind a first moment to be completed by a second moment. Thank you. You can't resist, right? I mean, that's the point. That rhythm. Well, what is it now? What is it about the rhythm? That what's the point of that little example? Anyone? Yeah, but now I want a bit of philosophy. I need to do it. This isn't kindergarten. I'm not testing your response. What's the philosophical point here? What is it about the first knock or the first three knocks that gives them their philosophical character? What's the philosophical thought happening there?
What's contained in the second?
Well, yeah, in what sense? It's that, and here's the point about the first three knocks, it's as if they're opening out, anticipating, looking for that their character as first is not, as it were, a raw dogma, that in light of the second, we suddenly recognize that the first was vectorial, that it was a stretching out, leaning, and openness towards the second, of which it is suddenly completed by the second, right? So that moment, so that every now, and we only have that, right? In light of, and here's the curious thing, our memory. So this anticipatory moment is actually a product of the holding in mind. So the holding in mind of the past is the way in which we lever ourselves toward the future, or get thrown toward the future, right? I mean, that's why pastness is thrownness. And Heidegger says this in his typically turgid way on page 120. It's 127 and 128 where he does the synthesis of reproduction. The being experienced earlier would constantly be lost completely with each now if it were not in general retainable. Hence, if empirical synthesis in the mode of reproduction is thereby to become possible, the no longer now as such, the no longer now as such, must in advance of and prior to all experience, that is, a priori, have been brought forth again and unified with a specific now. So that this is the transcendental. Right? So the point is that the very way in which our cognitive apparatus works is that we are always holding in mind the previous moment and being launched into, right, the future. I have spent, and I'm sure other people in this room will have some experiences, I've spent a lot of my life moving about across continents and across countries, and often I will wake up and I will suddenly have the experience, what country am I in and how old am I? That is, I will not be able to see, and it's because waking up is typically a moment in which there's no previous moment, so I'm not holding, and therefore I'm, as it were, there's that suddenly some mornings of waking up feels like starting from scratch, and I have to think, oh no, huh, I am, and then however old I am, and I'm in this country. And it's that now has lost its grip as a now, what should be the most, right? This is the critique of the present, the most authoritative experience is the experience, of course, with no authority because it is cut off from its past. So that it is cognitively empty until I can get a pass for which it's the present, right? Which is the terror of amnesia and the like. Right? You can now use empirical corollaries for this all over the place. Okay. So the thought here is by itself. Apprehension and reproduction constitute the possibility of minimum cognitive awareness. We have, if we have these experiences, we have access to some X. We are geared to it cognitively, that is, we are responding to it, which is to say, and let me get this out right, information about it is present to the mind such that my behavior with respect to it can be explained only by how it is represented, not how it actually is. That's the crux. This is, I can see you're really looking at this. Who am I arguing against and why am I saying these terrible things? There is in the non-Kantian literature and in various analytic theories of perception a notion of information that is not what it seems like. It's really about simply causality. That is, being causally affected by something alters my state. And in information theory, that will be a packet of information since it is differential. Now, I am suggesting here that we are not interested in mere causal differentiality here. I am suggesting that by means of apprehension and reproduction, we can explain my behavior with respect to the objects only in light of not its effects upon me, but upon my representational relationship to it. That is, I'm looking at it, investigating it, interrogating it, reflecting on it, trying to figure out, for example, what country I'm in, what room this is, who my wife is, and all these people my children, right? And all these kind of fundamental questions one asks first thing in the morning. Give or take. So, by means of apprehension and reproduction, let's say that I can attend, I can scrutinize, I can search, I can interrogate, and I can do all these things without being able to recognize the object attended to. That is, I can fail. I can get lost. I can be disoriented. My cognitive quest can come up empty-handed. But that tells me that it is a quest I'm on, and the quest is the third moment, recognition in a concept. So this is the third. Remember, each of these are separate syntheses that are only typically analytically separate. Typically, they all happen, often happen simultaneously. I'll say more about that in a moment. Recognition in a concept adds this what I'm attending to. It's not just a dark speck in the sky, but it is a bird. In making this recognition, I employ the category. I note its quantity. It's one, not two. It's a one thing, it's not an event. It has a certain shape. It has a quality. The shape is those of a bird, the wing shape, etc. And furthermore, I am seeing it, not merely imagining it. So the kind of mental act involved is present. And the like. Now, the crux here is that nothing but a concept will tell me what sort of complex happening I am responding to. For example, going back to the example from last week, hearing Big Ben. I must not just hold the earlier rings in mind, but hold them in mind as rings of a clock. Otherwise, it's just big boings, right? Kind of like the Hunchback of Notre Dame suffering there, you know? Oh, the bells, the bells! Charles Lawton, isn't it? If you haven't seen Charles Lawton as Quasimodo, I consider this an assignment for this class. The Hunchback of Notre Dame. The movie from 1938, just before the war. Anyway, okay. But the point is you've got to conceptualize it as not just noises, not just rings, because some rings can be a song, can be a rhythm, especially church bells, or they can be, I don't know about, the church in my local village in Wivenhoe, the carolers would do a tune. Nowadays they often do things like the Beatles. And then they would do the time, right? You know, Tuesday night was always, I lived right behind the church. It was so goddamn noisy. Anyway, but you had to know the difference between listening to the tune and then the halt and then boing, boing, I think, eight. Two different counting as, right? still listening for the bells, but under different conceptual descriptions, and therefore that discriminating the way in which I counted the tones, whether I bothered counting them or I synthesized them as a tune, and so forth and so on. Without those activities, what we have is simply orderly noise. The concepts make that noise into a song or a striking of the time or whatever. Okay, so and I want to read the Heidegger only because I want to show how the Heidegger can feed into an account that is non-Heideggerian, that is account of the threefold synthesis in a way is fine. It goes in ways that he doesn't suppose. Now, what is clear is that this recognition in a concept is driving the entire process, right? Because how I anticipate what I'm listening for, what sort of, let's call it cognitive projection, will, as it were, inform my apprehensions and reproductions. So that, as the saying goes, the last shall be first. So although this is a movement from the present into the past, into the future, that's the structure of ecstatic time, if you're interested, in Heidegger. Yes, I'll show you it is. Don't give me that look. It is. And I'll show you in a second. But it is here driven by recognition in a concept. So Heidegger rightly says here, it has thus been shown what emerged as the third synthesis in the characterization of the empirical genesis of conceptual development is in fact the first, i.e. the synthesis which in the first directs the other two characterize. It pops up in advance of them, so to speak. Kant gives the synthesis of identification a most appropriate name. Its unifying is a reconnoitering. It explores in advance and is watching out for what must be held before us in advance at the same, no, I'm sorry, what is held out in advance as the same. Right, so this is how the notion of unity and sameness gets introduced. So what must be held out before us in advance as the same, in order that the apprehending and reproducing synthesis in general can find a closed, circumscribed field of beings within which they can attach to what they bring forth and encounter, so to speak, and take strides as beings. So Heidegger's thought here is that this whole structure has about it an anticipatory foreshadowing opening up to the world as a mode of continual encountering of the given for the sake of the telos of making a conceptual identification. Well, Longuenesse, in the handout that's just been distributed, describes this as the a kind of mental the neighbors. Someone want to read that passage, that underline beginning with the one and only condition?
What page is this on?
Page 208 of Longwood S. Go ahead.
The one and only condition for relating representations to objects is the capacity to form judgments. The intentional relation of any of the three syntheses considered in the A deduction to an object depends on this capacity. To borrow a term from Spinoza and Leibniz, one might speak of an actual kinatus, a continual effort to shape the representation of what affects us in order to exercise our judgment. How do you pronounce that?
Kinatus or kinatus?
Kinatus. Kinatus is what makes our apprehension an act of running through and holding together, what orients the reproductions of imagination toward judgment, and finally what enables these reproductions to be recognized under concepts. This does not mean that apprehension and reproduction always lead to recognition. On the contrary, we may be affected by sensations that we apprehend without reproducing them, just as we may reproduce without the resulting reproductions leading to recognition, that is, discursive judgment. The sensation leads to intuition of an object only if it is apprehended in such a way as to be reproduced, and reproduced in such a way as to be recognized by virtue of one and the same intellectual kinatus. The actualization of this kinatus is the action of understanding on the sensibility, namely the synthesis speciosa, the figurative synthesis carried out by imagination.
We'll come to the notion of figurative synthesis in the B deduction, but where she's underlining the point that the A deduction and the B deduction are doing the same work. Now, what I want to underline here is, in a sense, the beginning of this passage, namely that what's driving all of this, first of all, is, you say recognition in a concept, but we've already learned that there's only one thing we can do with a concept. That is, make a judgment. So recognition in a concept is just another word for the process underlying or making possible the making of a judgment, and that furthermore, what judgments do, going back to the transcendental object equals X argument, is that they are the way in which we relate representations to objects. That is, making a judgment just is relating representations to objects and nothing else. There's no more to my relationship to the object than my making a judgment about it. And the making a judgment about it is the consequence of the threefold synthesis. So we now have the sense, right, that this, what sounded a bit like a strange kind of psychology, is really something else. It's trying to understand, let's say, the elemental moments that belong to judgment making, and the kind of elemental moments that appear when judgment fails. Not when judgments are false, but when we, as it were, don't get to the end of the process in various ways. So it's trying to understand how, again, how, getting to where we started, how the product, the Brown lectern, is the consequence of a complex synthetic process that is governed by and oriented by the ideal of making a judgment, and as we'll have to come to see, but we already have good reasons to suspect, making a judgment is governed by the categories. Okay. I promise. Tingly that I was going to show this is finite. This is projective understanding. This is, for those of you who, as I have, lots of hours. The present, the past, and the future. So this is indeed the structure of ecstatic temporality. And I won't go through it, but I have all the reason in the world to think. I mean, I view, unlike a lot of people, I view Being in Time as Heidegger's only truly Kantian book. I mean, I think. And there are complicated reasons about why he had this Kantian moment. Something like finishing the book had a lot to do with it. No, it was written in a hurry, and he just took whatever he had to hand. What he had to hand? Well, we all have to hand Kant. And he cooked it up into existential rather than cognitive categories. So that the right way to read Being in Time is as a translation manual in which cognitive categories are translated into existential categories, and that makes a lot of difference. I mean, there's a big story to be had here, but I want to say that that's what the underlying structure of Being in Time really is. That's if you think the issue of the book is the analytic of finitude and not the question of being. I'm an idealist, I don't think there is a question of being, right? I think that's a no question. Heidegger is just wrong about that, which is why Being in Time is his best book, right? It's the only book where he says it's about being, but it isn't. It's about interesting things like the world. That's my little rant. Okay. any questions about the threefold synthesis?
But then what do you think the sensibility, what is the position for sensibility in this head of the scene?
Well, the complaint about Heidegger is exactly through the translation, he loses significant sensibility. Right? And that's the argument I made when I said that existential space is just, phenomenological space is just inadequate as a notion of spatiality. So, and I think that's why he downplays sensibility, which is to say he downplays embodiment. Ironically, Kant does have a highly sublimated account of embodiment via the notions of space, time, and imagination. One of the things you may want to ask yourself when reading the critique is why is Kantian cognition different from Cartesian cognition? That is, why is Kant not a mind-body dualist in the same way that Descartes is? And I do want to say that the role of sensibility and embodiment is much thicker in Kant, and therefore the role of sensibility is much thicker in Kant. Yeah, sure.
Given the teleological sort of dynamic of these three syntheses, I worry then how the three syntheses could be logically, or at least how recognition could be logically sort of separate from the other two, given that
it... What do you mean by separate?
Well, this was your claim that these are three different syntheses that are logically, in some sense, they're not logically collapsible into each other. They're different moments.
I said they're analytically separate, which is not to say that they are actually separate.
Okay, well then maybe that answers the question, but just to round it out, because I don't see how you get reproduction independently of recognition. And maybe that's just right, because there's nothing to reproduce until you have an object and the object doesn't come until.
Right. Which is why when I gave my little song and dance about reproduction, I kept doing the little forward thing, trying to indicate to you that what pastness allows, right, is that movement towards openness, so that the deep effect of pastness, right, is to show the vectorial character of every now. So reproduction makes apprehension futural. And if it is futural, since obviously reproduction comes after, right, then the futural has to get picked up in a truly futural moment, recognition in the concept. Which is why I take it, I mean, I think it's kind of canny interesting that Longinus decided to use kinetis as the notion. Kinetis is the notion of a primitive drive, and it's what Nietzsche will call will to power. So it's desire as simply forward movement, not desire as lack. It's that orientational movement, but it's structured here, right, by a continual movement towards judgment. Yep.
Yes. Still then in Kant, because on this right side, this projective understanding, I agree. But on the left side, this present, past, future, which is in Kant only in sensibility, but you now make it, because in Kant this judgment, then it's only the present. In Kant, this concept categories, they are always, I think that Kant thinks them rather as a kind of present, as a kind of presence, or they are out of time, they are not in the time. Because it's only sensibility, it's the form of intuition only, and it's not in this concept. But then
who says?
Actually, it's Kant in the text.
Yeah, I'm trying to convince you otherwise, and I'm trying to convince you, and the reason again that I think Longinus was, as it were, trying to answer your objection before you got there, by saying no. What the temporalizing movement that it is. The reason I use the idea of ecstatic temporality is to try to convince you that, insofar as time is the form of inner sense. This is the fundamental structure. There's no awareness of time below this.
Because when you think this, you already think this subject as an existential subject, not as Kant. In Kant, the subject is rather subject who is judging a subject of judgment. It's not an existential subject.
And that's going to be, I'm going to try to convince you that's the second mistake, that there is no such subject. That's why I'm saying that I want to use a deflationary theory of the self. What I have to show, let me just try to anticipate, what you all should be looking for is I'm going to show that there's no isolatable self in Kant, that the notion of self is just a pole of judgment. There's no such thing as the self that, you know, is aware of stuff, and you know, that's just a mischaracterization of what Kant means by transcendental unity of that perception. I'm going to show it's just this process itself, and with a structural characterization. But your, I mean, but your reading is the classical one, and I have to deflate it. Yeah.
I was wondering what this down to the Big Ben, say, hitting 12 o'clock. You don't really have to remember the bells. You probably couldn't anyway. You just have to place them by number. In other words, you have it hits once, that's one. It hits two, you place one with two. It hits three, you place two with three. You'd never be able to hold it just the bells themselves. You forget them. You know, you can't do it. So, but if you didn't do the numbers, you'd still have a sense of time passing from some. Just because it could change whatever it was. I mean, I don't know what that would be. I mean, there is, are you suggesting that there's a process whereby you'd need this conscious memory process?
I'm saying that you won't have a notion. I'm saying it turns out to be aware of time passing, that minimum thing you're interested in, turns out to be immensely complicated. And we're going to say that, in fact, you can't do it without spatial awareness. It's the reputation of idealism. So the notion of time passing is complicated, but unavoidable for Kant. You're right to say it's unavoidable. There's always passing time, even on a lazy summer afternoon.
Flesh out what I'm trying to think or say. But given the relationship that you've established between apprehension and reproduction and recognition, what would the relation be with respect to schematism? Since the schematism is precisely different.
We don't know what the schematism is yet, so I'm not going to try to answer it.
Okay.
Yeah. We have no idea what it means, it's just a word.
I just want to be off of the subject, and I don't want the Heideggerian effect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what if it's about expressing this whole thing? I mean, what if all we have in the three synthesis is the expression of the judgment, which is apprehension, what gets in, reproduction, what, you know, I put in front of myself is the same. You know, it's like it's the
good
judgment.
Yep.
So all I have is the expression of it.
Right. So, no. That's great. That's absolutely great. What the argument of the transcendental object equals X, and what the transcendental deduction is going to try to convince you of, is that in expressing that judgment, you are in relationship to an independent world.
That's great.
Right. Yeah, that's it. That's the line. That there's nothing above that. That is your relationship to the world. You know, so the deep question, right, that's why I keep trying to underline this as a deflationary project, right? Because think about Locke, Leibniz, Hume, Descartes, all these guys. How do I get in relationship to the world, right? And it's hovering out there, and I can't get there. There's this veil, and I need God, and I need theodicies, and I need regularities, I need the imagination, and then if we're Hume, we despair, and we go play pool. In order to avoid madness, it's one of the most moments of deep pathos in Western philosophy, that skepticism threatens madness. We'll talk about human madness another time. But you realize that his own skeptical imagination unworlded him in a terrifying way. Right? Now, Kant's strategy is to try to convince us that we're already in touch with the world, and we don't have extra efforts so that the product, the judgment we're starting with, right, is a process, and the process is going to be the formation of a judgment. And in forming that judgment, our representations are, the phrase he uses over and over again, relation to an object. That's what it is to be in touch with the object. When I form the judgment, it's 12, that is my relationship to Big Ben. The thing out there, you know, all 400 feet tall and, you know, weighing, you know, 10 tons, whatever it does, you know. Well, the tower. Tall tower. Isn't it 400? It's big. Bigger than me, anyway. So, it has to be 400 feet. Okay. Good. So, anything else before we begin to talk about the self, the thing we've been avoiding talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks? You wouldn't think we could put like 5-6 weeks in the column and not mention it. Okay, I've done it. But I think I have to stop doing it. So, it is now, just now, that Kant's analysis begins to get difficult. This has all been in the foothills with our Sherpas. Now we have to begin to climb on our own. And everything is going to hang, as I suggested, on the problem of unity. That's Kant's thing. Kant's argument works with increasing complexity in roughly the following way. To be aware of something is to be aware of a complex whole, which is to say, a unity of some sort. I'm just doing that as a challenge to you. Give me an awareness that isn't an awareness of a complex whole, unity of some sort. All knowledge involves articulations, therefore, of a complex unity. From the transcendental object equals X argument, we know that the unity of the object is not in the object. That the kind of unity of the lectern that I'm interested in is not exactly in the object. It rather is something that is revealed by its concept. That is, it's the concept of an object, and in particular the concept of this object, namely being a lectern, that will give me the kind of unity that it possesses, and therefore give me the requisite kind of things I can say about it. So the thought here, now very schematically, is that there's going to be a unity of an object if and only if there is a unity of consciousness and there's going to be a unity of consciousness if and only if there is going to be a unity to the acts of recognition so unity again is never given in Kant. It's always an achievement and indeed always a kind of, as far as, I mean, he maybe overdoes it, but he always thinks a kind of fragile achievement. Right? We have the kind of unities we do. So we will have those acts of recognition, our syntheses. Now, if and only if we have the unity, and now we're just going to have a stupid word, we don't know what it means, of apperception. So somehow, all this unity folds back on what Tang was worried about, the unity of the self, this moment of apperception. Okay, let me try to say something. Is this a good moment for a break before I launch into the transcendental meaning of apperception? Oh yes, I can see. Yes, good moment for a break. Okay, let's have a 7:38 break.